Welcome to The Art of Mathematics. I'm Carol Jacoby, and joining us once again is Lee Krafchik, who is a lawyer, but he has a degree in math, and he's maintained his interest in math for many years. So I'd like to talk to him about that. Welcome to the show, Lee.
It's good to be back, Carol. It's always good to see you.
Thank you. Tell me about how do you keep yourself involved in math when you're not working in the area, you're not hanging out with mathematicians? Other than maybe me once in a while. There's a lot of reading, I assume. How do you do that?
It's a matter of what your interests are and what makes you feel comfortable. I think my advantage is when I read mathematics, it's for pure pleasure. I'm not working. And I guess the contrast would be when I'm reading law, that's work. And then if I read a legal novel or something like that, it's not as much fun. I'm too critical. I look at it from too much of a legal perspective. But when I'm reading math, I'm truly a tourist. It's like watching sports. You can enjoy it from just enough removed that you could see how well it's done. And I also realize you can't quite do it, but you can't criticize it because you don't know quite enough to know what the real problems are. The best part about it is when you read it from a layman's perspective, you see only the very most interesting stuff. I never get so far into the weeds that I'm not reading textbooks so much. I can't really say the last time I read a textbook. Occasionally I'll read something that requires figuring out a few problems and working your way through them, and that's enjoyable. Like right now, I'm catching up on Euclid's Elements. He's quite a good writer. I don't know if anybody's heard of Euclid, but his books go back 2,000 years ago. One of the things interesting about math is how it withstands time. His proofs, although they've been criticized and been proved over time, the essence of them continues to this day. And the way he laid them out, it's not too hard to follow. The geometry and the step-by-step way he does it, beginning with the postulates, and then works his way slowly through it. It's very enjoyable. It's not too challenging a read. Of course, you have to have a little bit of math background to know how proofs are developed, et cetera. But it's something that most anybody could read. And I think it's something that most educated people need to have at least an understanding of what Euclid did. Now, you may not have to read Euclid himself, but something about geometry is certainly worth reading. But to bring us a little more current, let's work our way through some of the other classics that I've enjoyed. And here's how I ended up reading them. When I was working full time, I worked downtown and I would always take the train in. And before computers and phones took over our lives, I would always carry a book and I'd read the book on the train. And it was a most enjoyable way to spend an hour or so back and forth. Here's some of the older ones that I think are just astounding. One is by this famous mathematician, G.H. Hardy. It's called A Mathematician's Apology. It doesn't require any real knowledge of mathematics. It's him describing what it's like to engage in mathematics. What does it mean to him? What is it like to develop a proof? What is so beautiful about it? And he was what would be called a Platonist. There's two competing schools of thought about what mathematics are. One is the Platonist school, which says that mathematics exists outside of us, that we're just discovering what it is. That is, we look and there really are such things as circles. There really are such things as angles and all these things that we use to measure. But they exist in a Platonic world outside of ourselves. There's a perfect circle. There's a perfect triangle. And all of the mathematics that we develop, the proofs, et cetera, that's out there for us to discover. We're not inventing it. The opposing school, the formalist school, says that everything we do is more of a developed by humans. And they reduce it to mathematics is just a game. We develop the rules and then we play with it and we make proofs and we manipulate the symbols and we manipulate the axioms and we come up with all kinds of interesting puzzles and solutions. But it's not outside of our own human existence. Without humans, you wouldn't have math. Platonists would say it exists independent of us. There's a lot of books that delve into that that contrast. And they're all very interesting. Another one is Men of Mathematics. There's a discussion in there by a fellow by the name of E.T. Bell, another old mathematician. He talks about how this develops through individual mathematicians and the proofs that they went through. He talks about their lives as mathematicians. In Men of Mathematics, he goes through proofs dating all the way back to Archimedes and all the way through to Cantor's continuum analyses and proofs. That's another one that's considered a classic. What I thought was interesting about that reading more recently was I thought that was like an established book accepted by all mathematicians and all academics. Then I read some subsequent works, and some of them don't like that book at all. They say he misconstrued mathematics and he misconstrued the mathematicians, and they were highly critical of him. I was surprised at how vicious some of the attacks were.
Really?
Yes.
I have to go back and read that because I remember it being very interesting, historical. I didn't think there was anything controversial in it other than, of course, the exclusion of women. But
yeah, that's true. That's always been a problem. But here's what one fella said. This is interesting. First of all, he said he got it wrong about who came up with the four-dimensional space with time as the fourth coordinate. But then this one other mathematician says, although Bell was admired for his science fiction and for his book Men of Mathematics, I was shocked when just a few years later, another mathematician pointed out that the book was nothing but a string of Hollywood scenarios. And my own study, he says, has shown me that Pitts, the other mathematician, was right. And now I find the contents of that still popular book to be little more than rehashes enlivened by nasty gossip and banal or indecent fancy. That's
well,
a pretty
no wonder it was so
review.
Interesting.
Maybe that's it. But on the other hand, there's other great mathematicians who were fully inspired by it. This is from a physicist, Freeman Dyson, a famous theoretical physicist. He said when he read the book, it was one of the most decisive moments of his career. Not only did he learn about mathematicians as human beings, but he also, that's what made him appreciate mathematics. And I had the same impression of the book, so I'm not in a position to criticize it. But I found it interesting that others found it objectionable, apparently, over the years. But it's a very well-established book and very popular and still well-read. The other classic that others may have heard of is Innumeracy, the book by John Paulos. A little volume, but it's chock full of interesting anecdotes and thoughtful appraisals of how poorly we normally understand mathematics in the real world. When you talk to somebody who doesn't either appreciate mathematics or just doesn't find it that interesting, you can see sometimes how they do fall into the traps that Paulos points out, the notion of confusing causation with correlation, the notion that just because there's a statistical relationship between two things doesn't mean they're truly related in a causal sense, or misuses of statistics in general. For instance, I think there was an example of he showed that there was something that was a 0.03 variation, whatever it was, and yet they had absolutely nothing to do with each other. It's just a random chance. You have to read more into things than just assuming because somebody tells you there's a mathematical relationship that there is. It takes a little bit of thought. He doesn't require the thoughts of a mathematician. He just wants us to think a little more critically about what we read. When we see something in the paper about somebody saw a relationship between, or they've come up with a statistic about this or that, and he said, well, take a moment to see if that correlation makes any sense. Just because they have a statistic doesn't mean it's true. And he points out a where it sometimes goes seriously wrong and affects our political environment. Great book, 1988 was written. And he's written a number since then that follows up on this. One was A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper, another, which was very good because now he's reading current events and saying, oh, here's where they went wrong. Here's what they missed. And then he has one called Beyond Innumeracy, which also follows up. One that's a little more challenging and more pure math than enumeracy that I really enjoyed was one called The Mathematical Experience by Philip Davis and Reuben Hirsch, written in 1981, but it was updated in 1995. My notes reflect here. This is more of an introduction to the philosophy of mathematics. And this is where you get a real excellent explanation of Platonism versus formalism. And he goes into detail about who advocated which position and why Platonism is so attractive to many mathematicians, but also why it doesn't fully explain everything that goes on in mathematics and why the formalist school may have a better view of what mathematics actually is. One of the things he pointed out, and others do the same, is that some discoveries in mathematics undermine the Platonist school. And the one example I keep coming across in these various books is the discovery of a non-Euclidean geometry. Because the notion was, before those geometries were discovered, the use of the word discovered is a little telling, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Once I say discovered, I sound like a Platonist. But if I was truly a formalist, I would have said, once somebody invented or created. But to me, it's a discovery. That's the way it sounds like to me. They found these non-Euclidean geometries. But in any event, what the writers typically say is, once these geometries came into play, that undercut any notion of Platonism, because Platonism was based on the notion that Euclidean geometry was the only geometry. You know, so if there's other things out there, well, you know, maybe we invented Euclidean geometry too. So, and I thought that's a telling thing. You know, when you find alternatives to the math that you thought was uncontrovertible, then, oh, maybe it is just a game, and if we change the rules, we're playing in a different field, and they're both good games, but neither one of them is the game of the gods, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's a great book. It won the 1983 National Book Awards, and it excellent explanation of what mathematics is about. Another one of the classics is Journey Through Genius by William Dunham from 1990, and he walks his way through the classic proofs, and he calls it Journey Through Genius. So he brings in the characters who came up with the proofs, talks a little bit about the characters, but talks more about their classic proofs. And some of them, he starts early on with Euclid's proof of the Pythagorean theorem. There's a lot of proofs of the Pythagorean theorem, but it's good to see one of the original ones. The belief is that was not Euclid's original proof, but he's the first one who put it in the text of the elements. I didn't know this until I read this book, was the proof of the infinitude of the primes was a Euclid proof. I didn't know that. I thought that was more modern. And for our listeners who don't know what the infinitude of the primes is, it basically says there's no final prime. There's no maximum prime. And the proof is kind of simple in a way. It basically says, take all, if there's a finite number of primes, multiply them all together and add one. Now, is that new number, is that prime? Well, it's not divisible evenly by any of the listed primes because it's plus one. So it's either prime or there's another number in between the list you had and this new number that must be prime that divides into it. You can see how you can express that. It's easy to do it having seen the proof. I don't think I could have ever come up on my own. But once you see it, say, wow, that's pretty cool. And apparently that was first published in 300 BC. One of the other ones he talks about is the non-denumerability of the continuum, the Cantor's proof that there's a difference in somewhat abstract sense between the size of the real numbers and the size of the integers. This next book is called Is God a Mathematician? It's a provocative title by this fellow, Mario Livio, from 2009. And he delves into that same general question, is math invented or discovered? His answer is interesting. He says it's both, which is a bit of an equivocation. If you were in a court of law, the judge would say, that's very nice, Mr. Livio, but we need an answer. You're here litigating a case and you can't just equivocate. What's your position? But he says it in a very thoughtful way. And where he explains it, I thought was interesting. And I think this is, you can tell me as a mathematician whether this rings true to you. He said that, noting from Hardy's, who's a Platonist, and he quotes from another book, Mathematics and the Imagination, which was a purely formalist explanation using that non-Euclidean argument. And he says, the reason it's both is that mathematicians, when they're actually working on a problem and they're deeply involved, then they're Platonists because they think it's out there and I just got to find it. I know it's out there and it's calling to me, and so to speak. But then when they're done and they write down the proof, and then they're a formalist again. Does that make sense?
It really does feel that way.
You're searching,
and then you find something and you say, oh, look what I just did. I did this. I created this. But until you actually get it, it's kind of a selfish thing.
Yes, you're looking for this beautiful thing and you know it's out there, or at least you feel it's out there.
Yes.
Sometimes I guess, you know, your intuition about what the results should be could be wrong, could be not provable, like the ones we were just mentioning. Once you write it down, then it starts to become, it's not quite as exciting in a way, because some proofs are, once you write them down, they say, well, then it says, well, of course, you know, obviously. Some proofs are just that way, that once you see them, it's not quite so fascinating. Till you see it, it's very challenging. And then that moment when you see the solution, that must be the most exciting. That's what I remember from my days in undergraduate school was, and then the same thing in law school every once in a while, or even as a lawyer, you're looking for a solution. You find it and you have this light goes off in your head. And then the next step of writing it down is not as much fun because you've already got the excitement out of it. But that's how it works. You get the inspiration and then you take the time to write it down in the proper sequence. Well, Carol, we've discussed a number of books. There's a lot more you could read, and perhaps between the two of us, we'll put together a list that you can add to the website. As you and I have mentioned and others have mentioned, there's one book that cannot be overlooked when you're talking about math books. It's simply brilliant. It's called Gödel, Escher, Bach.
Oh, yeah. That is my desert island book.
It's hard to describe completely. It covers so many topics, and it's just so well written and so fascinating. I read it some 40 years ago when it first came out, and I turn back to it occasionally, I'm just astounded by how brilliant it is. If you went on the web or you went on the video and look for that book, you'll find people teaching classes about it. You'll find videos about it, and if you ask anybody who knows anything about mathematics, and what books they like, almost every time this is number one. So I highly recommend it to anybody. It is challenging, but it's definitely worth reading.
And it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It's a self-referential book about self-reference. It's full of puns. Alice in Wonderland, things that you can read backwards and forwards. Very, very clever.
It's even a book you can recommend to somebody who doesn't particularly have a affinity for mathematics because it covers so many topics and it's so beautifully done and so entertaining. It's just a marvelous work. I don't know of any other books that I could recommend anywhere nearly as highly.
I agree with that.
Right.
So thank you very much, Lee. I want to hear more about your other books. He's got a wonderful list here, and now I'm motivated to go and read some of them.
Quite a few good ones in there.
Yes, there are.
Good to see you again, Carol.
Bye.
Take care.
You'll find a list of all the books on our website. theartofmathematicspodcast.com. And that's all one word. We'd love to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to share on the air or a suggestion for a guest for a future show, leave a message at anchor.fm/theartofmathematics with hyphens, or email me at cjacoby@jacobyconsulting.com. And if you'd like to learn how to get answers from data, check out my class at excelfordecisionmakers.com. See you next month. Thanks for listening.